good day. Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Today's program features Major Anthony L. from the Kansas City Police Department, and his topic is how not to be Ferguson. And we're going to hear how our city's police department approaches the challenges that led to such disastrous results in Ferguson this summer. So a very engaging and topical program for you today. This program was recorded on Sunday, November the 30th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. So let us go straight to the introduction. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Welcome to All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church and to the UU Forum. I'm Carolyn McDonald, a longtime member of the Forum Committee. Our mission is to provide a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values in the contemporary world. Since 1943, our 10 a.m. Sunday morning forum has brought interesting and provocative speakers to the greater Kansas City community, trying to nurture lively debate and critical thinking. Over the years, we've had many community leaders, activists, and citizens that have spoken on different political, social justice, educational, and artistic issues. One of our longest-running traditions is every January, whoever is mayor comes and speaks. We play an important part as one of the few places in Kansas City where these are presented on a routine basis in an arena of ideas that are open to the general public. We begin with a presentation by the speaker, 30, 35 minutes or so, followed by a Q&A session that needs to end by 11 o'clock. Then the conversation continues in a smaller room down the hall for those who wish to participate in further dialogue. These are an opportunity for a creative interchange of ideas, challenge your values, and maybe a reevaluation of what you thought was your initial understanding. Today, when we're done, we're actually going to be breaking into two groups. The teens are going to go with our speaker and be down on the lower level. Judith Cady will be taking him down with the teens. And then the rest of us who want to have further discussion will go down to the meeting room and have something facilitated by the forum committee. Now, we plan our schedule months in advance. However, as events began to unfold in Ferguson, our minister, Reverend Kendall Gibbons, suggested we should rearrange our schedule to try to figure out a way to respond to this. Since we have a long, long history of being a place for dialogue, the UU Forum seemed to be an appropriate place to try to generate additional conversation between the police and between the community. The more we're in dialogue and seeking understanding, the more likely it is that we can avoid some of the tragedy and the volatile situation that's in place in Ferguson now. It's in this spirit that we're going to have Major Anthony L. of the Kansas City Police Department speak to us. Kendall is the one who lined up and invited him, but she's in a way visiting her father who's in the hospital right now. So, Major Anthony L.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everybody. Thank you. I'd like to first start out and tell you a little bit about myself. There was no biography. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. There was no biography, for the benefit of this conversation here, just tell you a little bit about myself. I am 52 years old. I joined the Police Academy December 3rd, 1984. Approaching 30 years of service with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. And I had one nice gentleman tell me already, no way do I look that old. And I appreciate that. It always makes you feel good when somebody pats you on the back and tell you you're looking good at your age. But my rank is major on the police department. And for those that don't know the command structure, the structure, rank structure on the police department, you start out as an officer, and we have sergeant, captain and major, and then there's five deputy chief and chief of police. And our chief of police currently is Daryl Forte here in Kansas City. I've held a variety of assignments throughout my career. I've either been a supervisor or a commander since March 31st, 1991. And I've seen a lot in my tenure on the police department. I've been in command at the division level of East Central Patrol, which we're in now, East Patrol, South, violent crimes, property crimes, you name it, SOD. And it's been a very wonderful experience and career as I'm winding down within a few months from my retirement within April or May of next year. But with all that said, and also I'd like to let everyone know I'm a lifelong resident of Kansas City. And when I was asked to come here, it was by Alvin Brooks, who had contacted me after a representative here contacted him and wanted someone to come and talk about Ferguson. It was well before we knew that the grand jury decision would be announced last Monday. So just in case anybody thought that this was just something that wasn't planned or just happened after that, it wasn't. It was planned long before that. But when we look at what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and one of the questions that we have here is how does the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department approach the challenges that led to such disastrous results in Ferguson this summer? August 9th, 2014, everyone all knows that on that date, Police Officer Darren Wilson, Ferguson, Missouri, got into an encounter with an 18-year-old by the name of Michael Brown, which subsequently led to Officer Wilson shooting and killing him. When we first heard about it in the aftermath, it was a developing situation very fast. It happened on a Saturday. The next day, that Sunday, is when the protests began, the riots began, the Quick Trip was burned down. By Monday, it was a mass show of law enforcement in response to the protesters and the unrest there in the community. And that went on for about a week or so until things just got it hasn't gotten back to normal, but things calmed down. They weren't near the height or the number of protests or the demonstration which they were having. And we, like most police departments across this country, look at that situation and want to get all the facts. I mean, we know that there are challenges, there are going to be lessons learned from there. So currently, the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, like other police departments, we're in a position where we know that there will be some lessons learned, there will be some challenges that we face, and there will be some things that come out of Ferguson that may change the way, not only the way we do policing, but the way policing could be done across the country for the betterment of the community that we serve. You know, so the question would be, what are the challenges that we would face? We know that in that particular situation, one of the challenges is, and it's been talked about early on, is underlying issues within the community. And those underlying issues, in particular Ferguson, in my opinion, deal with race and how a certain community is policed and how individuals feel that they are being treated. And all of this, when a critical incident happens, it can be very, very volatile in a community. This is the second time in my 29-year career that I have seen or been a part of a national incident. And I say a national incident because this is not only local to St. Louis. It's, as we've seen since the grand jury decision was announced, we've seen protests across the country from the West Coast to the East Coast in the aftermath of it. So when we look at when I look at this, I quickly think about in 1992, the Rodney King verdict, and what happened in Los Angeles with 5 days of rioting, 1,000 buildings that were burned, 53 people were killed. And that incident, after officers that were indicted and charged in that case were not convicted in the uprise. Well, since then, there has been numerous reports written on the L.A. riot. Kansas City, Missouri Police Department has been no different in looking at the lessons learned from it. What you can do and what can you do to prevent that situation occurring. But just like with Rodney King and the Rodney King situation and now, that underlying issue in there has to deal with race and how people perceive the police in the minority community. Unfortunately, we are not perceived favorably in most communities across the country. I probably better say in all communities. There are people who simply don't like the police because of their experiences, their perceptions, and how they have shaped their image of police. I think the image of police now, and in some people's mind, is probably worse than it was when I joined the police department 30 years ago. You know, and why is that? That's one of the challenges that we have to face and have to deal with, and how we improve our image. And I can tell you that Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, when I started, there were no community type of initiatives or programs or approaches in which the department worked with the community. Now, and since that time, there have been different chiefs who've come in and did different initiatives. I can think early on when Steve Bishop was our chief, he implemented the community policing philosophy. That community policing philosophy brought policemen into the neighborhoods, brought them in to work with residents, work with neighborhood association with crime and quality of life issues. That was a first for us with the community policing trend. It was a big change for us. You know, a lot of police officers, when they came on the job, they came on with a simple mission: to put people in jail and have fun. That was what they did. They didn't think that they needed to partner with the community to understand the importance of that. But as we progressed into community policing we were very successful in that. From that, we had our first police athletic league start with the West Side Can Center over in Center Zone. Now, 2014, we have a beautiful facility at 17th and White with our police athletic league down there. And the police athletic league is a very positive thing, because what it does, it puts policemen and kids together. It puts them together in a positive atmosphere, and it helps show them that police are not their enemy, that the police are good people and police want to help. And we continue to serve kids, low-income neighborhoods in Kansas City with our Police Athletic League program, and it was very, very positive for us that we were able to do that. Along with that, we've had our Police Explorers. We've had different types of initiatives and partnerships with police. Our buildings, a lot of people don't know this, that our buildings, the taxpayers in Kansas City are responsible for those brand new shiny buildings that we have. They passed the public safety sales tax initiative for capital improvements for the construction. Part of in the planning of that was, and getting input from the community and what the community wanted. We have north, we have athletic fields up there that high school team or little league teams use to practice football on. We have our community rooms, and all of our stations are open to the public to have meetings there and things like that. Our gym, we have a huge multi-purpose building on the South Patrol Special Operations Division campus, which is open. But with all of those things, the goal was including the community, making the community part of what you're doing. And that's important. Here in Kansas City, fortunately, in 1992, when we had the Rodney King verdict, and then again in 2014 with the grand jury decision in Ferguson, we did not have a large protest march or negative reaction from local community in support of what's something that happened outside. For the most part, our reputation and our relationship with communities in Kansas City is very positive. Fragile, though. It's very fragile, especially in some of our low-income areas and areas within the African-American community, which, from what we've seen, can be some of the most volatile in reaction to policing or police actions. Because this is a community that there are a number of people feel that they are policed or treated differently because of the color of their skin. But fortunately for us, we have continued to work, and it's not a finished, it's not finished by all means. We still have a lot to do. Our relationship with the community can be a lot better, but it can be a lot worse than what we have. We still have a lot of problems and things that we face. But also, when you look at the challenges, you have to know what they are. And we don't know what all the challenges are going to come out of Ferguson. We know community relations is going to be a huge challenge, you know, and how that happened. We know that there are going to be questions of how officers are trained. how and use of force policies and things like that. Some departments have already been proactive with the use of de-escalation training, where the officers use words or gestures instead of being confrontational, reaching for a weapon. And that's very important. Also, in part of that de-escalation, it may be the need to recognize when you need to have more officers involved in a situation, and where just the sheer number of officers there, officers' presence at a situation, de-escalates someone's behavior. We also have recognized through incidents that happened here and across the country the need to have trained officers to deal with individuals that may be suffering from type of mental health issue. Those are our CIT officers. We have an active CIT program. Those CIT officers can make a lot of difference in how a situation is handled, and in particular, how someone is treated when they are encountered by the police. We also have, over the years, when I came on to the police department, we still had 38 caliber revolvers, Model 64. You had 6 rounds in your gun, and then you had another 6 rounds that were in individual slots on top of your handcuff case. Not real easy to get to if you had to actually reload, but that's what we had. And we had a wooden nightstick, and that was it. We relied on that and our training, our defensive tactics. Back then, when the academy was 4 months, it's about 6 months now. And a lot of the things that are taught in the academy, or most of them, the entire curriculum has to be approved by POST, which is Missouri Police Officers and Standards Training that we have. But within the last 30 years, we've seen a lot of technology come into policing, technology that has helped us do our jobs and help make and help save lives. We didn't have the option of pepper spray when we encountered someone who was active resistant or assaultive toward the police, and we came in a situation where the only option we had was physical force or your baton. We later changed the nightstick from the wooden stick to the PR-24. As time went on and technology continued to increase, we saw the advent of the taser and the tasers. They have been very controversial as far as the tasers go. But I can tell you from my experience, since we have had the tasers on the police department, there have been lives saved. Had we not had the taser option, the option may have been deadly force that the officer used in that particular situation. So the tasers are important. When we deal with individuals, and we're in a situation where we're not a deadly force, but we need to use some force to stop them, they've given us other technologies such as beanbag rounds. And a beanbag round is a round that's fired from a 12-gauge shotgun. It's a beanbag round, and it's basically used to stun someone to give you the ability then to take them under control. And these officers that are here in Kansas City, on a daily basis, they put their life on the line, and they face a number of different challenges in dealing with individuals in the community when they're answering calls. So the technology is improved. And I know that a lot has been said so far on the Ferguson issue as far as in-car video, body cameras. That is one of the challenges that law enforcement agencies are going to have to face and look at. In Kansas City, it didn't come from the police department on in-car video. In-car video came from outside the police department. At that time, it was City Councilman Alvin Brooks, who wanted to have police in-car video to record all traffic stops and car checks on the system. City supported that idea. The police department got on board, and we were then implemented the in-car video. The in-car video is very important. For a lot of citizens, it helps them. They believe it helps keep the police accountable. It helps them to be able to have actual video footage on what happened. And for us, it's a very valuable investigative tool when a complaint is made. It's very easy to go to the video. Now, the next step from that And when after the Ferguson shooting happened, they began to look at body cameras, because body cameras were something the Ferguson Police Department did have, but they had not issued them to their officers. And most of us and most of the people who are looking at that situation knows that had he had a body camera, or there may have been a camera in that car, the facts and circumstances in that would probably be a lot easier to judge and investigate when you have that. Kansas City, Missouri Police Department will be looking at body cameras. As of, I think it was 2 months ago, shortly after the Ferguson incident, there was only one police department in the state of Missouri that had body cameras. That's going to change. It's going to take time, because just like any other organization, the police departments are strapped for money, finances, where they're going to get it from. But somehow, some way, we always find somewhere to get the money from, whether it's federal grant, cities got some money somewhere, especially when you look at what it's going to bring. Not the cost, but what it's going to bring. And is it going to increase that trust factor with you and the community now that you have it? But with all that said, there's a certain portion of the community who believe that the police officers have no right to come into their home and be videoing while they're inside their home. So we got some legal hurdles to jump over and some challenges there. Not all people feel we should have it. But I think what's going to happen is we're going to research it, we're going to look at that challenge, and we're going to come up with the best option for Kansas City, Missouri police officers, and in time, we're going to have the body cameras. And I think Chief Forte has already designated a commander who is going to be chairing that group or that committee that's looking at the body cameras. So those are going to be very important. And when you look at personal training and what you are teaching your personnel as far as interacting with people and understanding that people are different, and how they may perceive you as a police officer and how you may perceive them. We have training in which we teach officers verbal judo and how to avoid de-escalating a conflict, or when you have a person there that is not complying. And there's a verbal back and forth between you. What are some of the things that you can do to help avoid a physical confrontation? We also look at the effects and how the unintentional bias affects the police work. And there are unintentional bias effects of police work. The more these views diverge, the more likely they immediately see the others as a threat. And when that happens, conflict is inevitable. So those are some of the things that we looked at, or we know right now on the surface, and I know there's going to be a lot of other issues that come up. And as we know, the governor has already convened a committee to look at Ferguson, and I'm quite sure that's going to take some time, and there's going to be a report, and there's going to be some recommendations out of that. But I can say Kansas City, Missouri Police Department will carefully research the challenges from the lessons learned and implement changes designed to help make KCPD a better department for the community it serves. And no changes will come overnight, and some will take more time than others, but we're committed to helping improve the quality of police services which we provide. So we still have a long way to go as far as improving. There's a lot of things in there we know we do right, and there's some things that we can improve on. Yeah, but what we can't do everything alone. Citizens play a huge role in what your police department looks like, and you should. It's your police department. We protect and we serve this community. You should have input. Our Board of Police Commissioners are appointed by the governor. We are the only police department in the United States that is not city controlled. St. Louis was under the same state control until recently when they went city control, which left us. And there's been a lot of debate back and forth and what have you on the city control. But one thing we have with our Board of Police Commissioners, they meet every month. One of the things they have during that, they have a public comment section for every board meeting where anyone from the public can come and make comments to the board on different issues or different things they feel that need to be brought to the board's attention. So that's one way citizens can be heard, by coming to those board meetings or contacting them and contacting them for your input or any issues or concerns you have. And the other thing, the next thing that I was asked to talk about was, what can we as citizens do to support law enforcement and hold it accountable? That's big. That's big. Support law enforcement. One of the easiest things that you can do to support law enforcement is obey the law and raise your children to do the same. It makes it easier for us when people obey the law. We'd be out of a job if everybody obeyed the law. But I mean, we know that's not the case. But obeying the law is very important, and that's the message that the police department continues to put out. But it's also a message that the community can put out to the residents within their immediate circle on obeying the law and the importance. You can also be proactive in the utilization of crime prevention strategies. That helps support us. When we have a burglar in an area and we have crime tips that we're passing out and things that we're asking to do, when you follow those and help and do those crime prevention techniques, simple things like porch lights and lights around your home, and when they do come out and do the crime surveys, which our community interaction officers at the division stations do, those things that we ask you to do help support us. Being a part of a neighborhood association that works with police in addressing crime and quality of life issues also helps us. Driving safely, obeying the speed limit, which, you know, sometimes it's hard for us to do, but it's important. It's very important. You know, support some of the campaigns, such as the Click It and Ticket. That Click It and Ticket campaign, for those who don't know, is an annual campaign that police departments across the state to enforce wearing of seatbelts and seatbelt enforcement. It's very important. When you look at the statistics, when you look at the studies on fatal crashes and what some of the factors are, not wearing the seatbelt is right up there at the top. And so we know seatbelts do save lives, and they make the difference in people surviving crashes. Also, DUIs. We see those DUI campaigns, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Supporting efforts like that helps law enforcement and also helps make the community safe. The other thing that you can do to help support law enforcement is report criminal activity. If you witness a crime, cooperate with the police. Not wanting to get involved doesn't help the police, and it may allow the offender to continue victimizing others in the community. So it's very important. We have a lot of science now, and technology we didn't have before, with DNA and a lot of other different things that are available for us. But some cases we don't solve unless we get somebody that has the courage to step up and help the police in solving and reporting what they saw. So that's how you support, you know, your law enforcement, by being involved and helping and supporting, you know. And the other thing is to help. What helps law enforcement? Don't take the law into your own hands. You're not helping law enforcement, supporting us when you do that. Call the police. Do not take the law into your own hands. You know, if there may be a situation which you feel you're compelled to do something, as a good Samaritan, whatever, we understand. But for the most part, we always encourage people, let us deal with the problem. Don't you get yourself involved. The last thing that I was asked to talk about is law enforcement accountability and how important that is. You know, there's high expectations in law enforcement, and I think they're probably higher now than they've ever been. You know, police officer accountability involves holding both individual police officers as well as law enforcement agencies responsible for effectively delivering basic services of crime control and maintaining order while treating individuals fairly within the bounds of the law. Police are expected to uphold the laws regarding due process, search and seizure, arrest, discrimination, as well as other laws related to equal employment, sexual harassment, etc. Holding the police accountable is important for maintaining public faith in the police. You have to have it in order to have that. Citizens do this through their elected officials, who serve to keep the police accountable and reflect the will of the people. And it's important. Your elected officials, I'll give you one example of that. I mentioned about DNA and how DNA has been a very important tool in law enforcement helping us. It's also been a very important tool for individuals who have been, what we found out, wrongly convicted or improperly convicted. From that effort, they identified some key factors when they looked at those cases of individuals. They went back and they found out that they did not commit the crime through DNA. They found out two factors. Interrogations by the police was key in their conviction, and whether that interrogation was false or forced, and eyewitness testimony, and how eyewitness testimony can be misleading, inaccurate, or untruthful. There was a recent case I was reading, a gentleman who had been incarcerated for 39 years. He was just released because the eyewitness came back and recanted and said he lied. 39 years later. So, what elected officials began to do after that, they began to look at that and look at the challenges that we'll face. We started to see interrogations by law had to be interviewed. It was a prosecutor here locally who had introduced the bill in Jefferson City to get the law passed. So now we are required to record all custodial interrogations for a number of crimes, from murder down to your most serious felonies. Not all felonies, but your most serious, which include murder, robbery, rape, kidnapping, sexual abuse of a child, and etc. Those serious incidents. So what people feel that does now, it holds the police accountable. The videos will hold accountable for properly following the law and properly conducting interrogation. So that's how your elected officials can be involved, is one example of it. So citizens can also do it through individuals elected outside of here, state or federal level. There's been a number of different federal approaches or federal initiatives to reform policing. For the most part, a lot of the reform has not occurred to what most people were pushing for. The focus has been with other organizations. There are organizations that are formed that are responsible for overseeing accountability of police organizations in the United States. Their focus is to curb instances of police abuse, changing legislation, prompting awareness, encouraging people to document incidents of abuse. You can go online and you can look up those organizations who have taken on that task. Locally for us, another thing we have in place with KCPD is our Office of Community Complaints. And our Office of Community Complaints is where citizens can go file complaints against officers that they feel have mistreated them or wrongdoing. And the last thing I'd like to say as far as the accountability is the theory of transparency, or the philosophy of transparency. That's something that probably has come to light within the last 10 years in law enforcement, where law enforcement agencies are now becoming more transparent. They want to be able to open up where people could see, and we're not hiding anything, we're covering up, and we're going to be transparent on what we're doing and why we're doing it. And those were some of the issues, as we know, in Ferguson, as far as a challenge for them is early on in that investigation, what information was being released and wasn't, and that they had the appearance of not being transparent in what they were doing. And then I know we're getting close to the Q&A time, and I don't want to take away from that because I feel like that's one of the most important reasons I'm here today. But I'd also like to make sure everyone gets a copy of this. This document, which I'm holding, is by our Office of Community Complaints. This was done years ago, where the police recognized there's a need on our part to help people understand and educate on what to do when they are stopped by police. It's a guide on interacting with law enforcement issued by our Office of Citizens Complaints. I got a copy here, and you can also get this online. It talks about what to do when you're stopped, if you're in the car, on the street, or in your home. So we have been attending community meetings. We go to schools. I recently went to Center High School, talked to two groups of kids about that, and we talked about this document, what's expected from them. And that. So I have that for everybody, but
at this time,
I'd like to open it up for questions.
Okay, let me.
You're listening to Major Anthony L. from the Kansas City Police Department talking about how the mistakes in Ferguson hopefully cannot happen here. We're going to take a break. We owe you some messages. Let's do those, and we'll be back with questions from the audience for Major L. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Have a little spare time? Always wanted to be in radio? Well, then come on down and get involved in your community radio station, 90.1 FM, KKFI. On the air or behind the scenes, we need your help, and it's lots of fun, too. For more information, call Bill at the KKFI offices at 816-994-7869.
Hey, I'm Nick Spitzer, host of American Roots. Each week, we bring you music and artist interviews from across the American soundscape. Blues and jazz, old-time country and gospel, roots rock and soul, Zydeco, Tejano, and beyond. Join me on the journey on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Wednesday nights from 7:30 to 9:30, right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.
This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, in the spirit of the season, we talk to an economist and theologian and ask him, would Jesus be a capitalist? Then hear from another Jesus, Chuy Negrete, sing Corrido, Ballads of Mexican Workers in the Midwest. That's Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
How does your academy training process address the issue of appropriate law enforcement while respecting people's constitutional rights?
They approach it during the academy with the entrant officer classes, and there's a block on laws and constitutional law and training and bringing in outside speakers or professors or people knowledgeable in the field. Our legal advisors, we have our own Office of General Counsel. They'll come in. They'll discuss with the recruits about the Constitution issues, their job. They talk about different Supreme Court decisions, Miranda, and things like that. But then also, after you get out of the academy, there's a continuation of that because we know there are decisions handed down by the Supreme Court that affect how we do policing. So every year in annual in-service training, officers, sergeants, and this year everybody had to go, even yours truly, which normally it's 3 days that the commanders don't have to go. They have separate training. But that's how it's done on the police department. It's continued.
Has the easy access to guns by the public in general, as well as what appears to be in many locations, open season on police officers, affected how officers are feeling or reacting to the intense situations?
I wouldn't say it's open season, thank God, on police officers. Thank God that it's not. I know that they annually look at the numbers annually as far as officers killed in the line of duty. And they had a program this year called Below 100, where the goal was to get it below 100. But unfortunately, we did not nationally make that goal. The accessibility of weapons has been an issue in the community for years, and how people get a hold of weapons and the decisions they make once they do. And we, in my opinion, in law enforcement, when you have a conflict and there's an easy accessibility of weapons and there's poor anger management skills, all of those things are going to come together probably for a shooting or a homicide. We know that from law enforcement, it's about enforcing the gun laws, making and doing what we can in training there to make our officers safe as possible. There have been changes in the laws that affect us. When I came on, there was no such thing as concealed carry. Well, now with the law change in concealed carry, where you don't even have to have a permit to have it in your car, potentially for officers, when you walk up to that car, anybody in that car can have a gun. Unfortunately, here locally in Topeka, we've seen three officers in situations where they're approaching cars lost their lives. And the chief, after the first one happened 18 months ago, Chief Palmer, who used to be Kansas City, Kansas's chief, was here at the academy talking to us about it. It was two weeks after that where another officer on a car stop in Topeka, his police department, lost his life. So it's very dangerous for us. It's a dangerous job in doing that. We look at the training. We just went, you know, training I just went through. There's a lot of videos that officers see in training on what can happen when you're approaching a car or doing a traffic stop and how some of the shootings occurred, lessons learned from them, and things like that. So we have to do, as a community, as a country, we have to better educate people on weapons, especially our kids growing up. And that's when you mold them and you shape their minds as far as guns. It's okay to own a gun. It's okay to have guns for hunting. It's okay that guns are part of this culture in America. It's the decisions that you make when you own a gun. And as a gun owner, you have to make responsible decisions.
Would you comment on the subject of the militarization of police?
Good SWAT question.
SWAT teams and use of war equipment and what have you.
Good question. And I'm sorry, that is a challenge from the Ferguson incident, which we know exists and what we're going to be faced with. I'm not sure what all was in Ferguson as far as equipment. I can tell you from what I've seen, what everyone else has seen. I never went there on television. But I do know that there are 55 law enforcement agencies in that region. Don't know how many went there, but it's my understanding quite a few went there. With them, they bring a lot of equipment in. And when I think the community for the first time saw that much equipment, military equipment, in one particular location in response to one situation, people began to really look at that and say, wow, where in the world did they get all of this stuff? So we're going to have to, a challenge for us is if we're going to continue to get military equipment, we're going to be challenged on it by the community on based on need and why do we have it. Certain things that I don't think people would argue. We have been getting military equipment since late 80s, early 90s here in Kansas City. Some of the first we got some of the old. We actually, our first tank was far, to me, it was far more menacing than anything you saw in Ferguson. We had a Vietnam-era V-100 armored personnel carrier. That's what we rolled out on the streets when we had a tactical Operation 100, as we call it. We no longer have it anymore. We replaced that with some military-issued peacekeeper vehicles built on a Dodge chassis. They could withstand light armor, handguns in particular, but no heavy armor or anything like that. But as time went on, we began to get other things. We got boots from the military. We got, at a time when we were trying to phase out our Schweitzer helicopters that we had, the police department was looking at options. One of the options was purchase new helicopters. That was not going to be something that we could afford to do based on our budget. But what we could afford to do was accept military Vietnam-era helicopters with extra engine and parts. So for years, that helicopter that flew here in Kansas City, that was part of that military thing. But the militarization is we are a paramilitary organization, and at times we've had aspects, especially in our tactical units. Whenever you see our tactical units and they're deploying, they do look like military or army troops when they deploy. But a lot of that, the equipment that they wear is tactical for tactical and officer safety purposes because of the situations of what we're asking them to do and the mission we're carrying out. And for me, when we look at the challenge of it, I think we have to be able to show the equipment in which we have a need for it. And the government should ensure that when they give it to law enforcement, there is a reasonable and clear need that law enforcement is going to use this in the community.
Sir, I'd like to thank you for being here and for your three decades of service.
Thank you.
So I think what I'm concerned most is about militarization more even of equipment than the mind, as we know, in police work. So how do we as citizens, if we do all these things that you recommended, I work with the police department in anti-racism training. I'm a mediator for the city hall. I work with the mounted police. I've done all this. And yet, of all this that we all do collectively and be accountable to the police commission, we cannot help save our young people. I'm heartbroken that our young people are being murdered or killed Their lives have been taken in a disproportionate use of force, and that, you know, what is it about our culture and the police culture? What can we do to support you to ensure that doesn't happen? And disproportionately, our black men and our brown men of color, 20, 25 times the rate. So all of our young people, how can we support that and support you in doing that? Because it's just untenable. We're losing them in a very unfortunate way.
And I know that's going to be one of the huge challenges that we look at as a police department and we look at it as a nation. When you look at the numbers and when you look at what appears to be a disproportionate, or not even appears, it is, of African Americans who are killed by the police. And we need to look at what are the root causes. What are the perceptions, the attitudes, what are the training, what's going on that we are getting those results. So I think that's something that I don't have the answers for right now, but I think that as time goes on, we need people from the community to give input and be involved in that discussion and help shape whatever recommendations or whatever solutions we can implement to stop it.
Hi, I have a quick comment and a question. Mm-hmm. So my comment is I appreciate that this forum is happening. Mm-hmm. I am troubled by the fact of the title of this forum, How Not to Be Ferguson. To me, that puts the onus on the community of respectability politics. How can we just act right and the police will treat us right? And we know time and time again, no matter what black and brown people do, they are often faced by police discrimination, police brutality. So So that's my comment, is that the title of this is not very helpful. My question, though, is related to, I guess if you can comment about what the discussion has happened in the police department regarding the protests that have happened in the last few days. In particular, the first night when there was a woman whose foot was trampled on by a police officer. There have been reports there wasn't much empathy. There were reports there was police officers were flipping protesters off. And in particular, why was there riot gear out in Westport when people got there when there hadn't been any violence? Why was there this already anticipation of violence when nothing had already even happened?
Now, I think in response, I know you made comments, but in response to your comments on how not to be a Ferguson, that probably is on the police department more than anybody. So I don't think it's saying that the citizens actually have a way of preventing it or that. It's probably on us. Because most of those situations that we talked about, we have more control on the outcome than the citizen does. When you're talking about Rodney King or you're talking about anything else that's happened across the country, we do. And so for us, we look at and examine how can we avoid or not be in a situation like that. What is it that we need to do as far as the training? Now, the other night, it's my understanding. I was working that night on the protest, and it started from about Brush Creek or Manuel Cleaver and Prospect and went all the way to Westport. And that's a long walk. So I commend the people who did it back there and back. I know that some people couldn't make it that way. Police department brought in the ATA bus or called for the ATA bus there. It's my understanding that the lady who was stepped on by one of the horses. Now, I don't know how that happened. Based on the little, I don't know, the little I know about the Mounted Patrol program and the training, I would probably say it shouldn't have happened. Based on what we teach them and really the safety of the people when the horse is around. Westport, that's something that I would have to look into to give you an answer on why they were dressed the way they are. And when you say riot gear, can you describe what they had on?
Shields, lines of police, helmets. These things are
okay.
If there's not already violence happening, why is this gear already out there? So,
well, we've dealt with protests over the years, and we have always, since we implemented our field force training. Our field force training is training that we implemented here in Kansas City after the riots in L.A. And the field force concept, and I don't want to get into explaining it, but part of that is the shields and the readiness. We deal with protests on a small scale, nowhere near Ferguson. And depending on the circumstances, that we have as far as a threat assessment, what we know, we may deploy the shield van and the shields never come out the vehicle. It may be a case that that the commander, whoever was in charge that night, felt they wanted to have the shields at the ready there in the event that someone started, it became rowdy and someone started throwing bottles or rocks or batteries or something for the officers to protect themselves. Did they ever get into what we call a skirmish line, or were they just standing along there?
They surrounded the protesters, mm-hmm. and several people were arrested, and someone I personally know was arrested. And
was
arrested and was roughed up by the police and is still bruised and sore.
What I would like would suggest to you, if you have a way of getting in touch with them, is to make them aware of our Office of Citizens' Complaints, encourage them to come down and file a complaint and have it investigated. And like I said, it's hard for me to comment on what was going on that night, what was the strategy, what they were trying to do. I know that there was one reporter that was arrested, and it was told, it was reported to me that after numerous times told to get out of the street, and the reporter continued to do it, then the arrest was made.
Hello, Major.
Hello, Mr. Jackson. How are you?
Fine, yourself. First, I want to thank you for your 3 decades of service and all the hard work you've done for our community. And Kansas City Police Department does an excellent job of trying to be of being transparent with the Citizens Police Academy and all the different things they mm-hmm. do. But my question goes more in this Ms. vein. What can we do to, not Kansas City, but the suburbs? If you're a minority, you know there's certain suburbs you don't go through at night. And they already have their pre-planned excuses as why you've been stopped. And Missouri, for the 4th year in a row, has stopped more minorities than they have non-minorities, where the traffic stops for minorities have yielded less results than those of other races. What can we do to look at curbing that as a part of this problem, which is when I was in Ferguson, people said they were tired of being sick and tired of certain situations. And there's a stretch right outside of St. Louis, which Ferguson's a suburb, where police looked at ticketing people right in that area, which is some of the problem that's beginning to boil here. When you go to certain suburbs, you know, name one, Lee Summit, Raytown, a couple others, that after 9, 10 o'clock at night, you can look at being stopped and being told, well, the light over your license plate was out.
Mm-hmm. I can't even speak, Mr. Jackson, as far as KCPD on the racial profiling number since we've been required to report them, what we have done in response to them. I know Dr. Ken Novak at UMKC is who's charged with looking at those numbers. And I know he was recently interviewed and talked about the numbers itself don't tell the full story. You have to look to see in those areas what the police was going on, what type of problems they were working, and what have you. Not making any excuses for it. I think it's frustrating for us, and I say us as far as police department, the commanders on the police department who've been looking at those numbers for for years now, and we want to know what can we objectively take from this? What does it mean? You know, and looking at those numbers. Agencies outside of Kansas City, I know I saw the numbers on Ferguson and what have you, those numbers create a huge problem. They create a problem because of the perception. And people feel the numbers don't lie. And how can you stand up there and defend the numbers when it shows how disproportionately the number of African Americans or minorities being stopped, arrested, and what have you? And those numbers is probably going to be part of the discussion here. How does Missouri better analyze those and address racial profiling when they see it or when it's identified with a particular police department? You know, so my career, it's just been something that I just wanted to happen a long time ago, and for whatever reason it has not happened. And I don't know, you know, can you go online, Mr. Jackson, and get those racial profiling numbers and get them? And for those who don't know, those are the numbers that we're required to report when we make a stop, a traffic stop, or what have you. And look at that. Okay.
Okay. A little different type of question on violence. When there are charges of sexual abuse, sexual harassment, or rape of one police officer or person towards another, how many of those go to a prosecutor And what are the numbers on those in the Kansas City Police Department?
I don't know what the numbers are on the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. I can tell you currently, if a member of the department has an allegation of a criminal allegation against them, and it's investigated, in particular domestic, what we may see, and I don't want to say often, but what's common, and thank God it's not often, but it does happen, domestic violence, police officers involved in it, we will normally present those cases to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor will review and make a decision on whether or not the officer is charged or not on those. I don't know. We don't keep any statistics on those internally with the police department on how many times that happens in a year and what have you. But when it does happen, that's the process. They're investigated.
Thank you for being here. It seems like the police department as a whole is trying to do good work, but it also seems that individuals need to be culled out of police departments. And I'm not seeing that police departments are not doing as good a job maybe as they should to help make sure that individuals who believe they are the law are removed in a timely manner. And that seems to be, in my opinion, the problem. So how is it that this police department can actively call out, listen to the community, and implement these kinds of actions within?
Well, the question you have as far as you're not seeing a lot of it's not reported because of the employment laws and rights of an individual. And when we go through an internal disciplinary process and someone is terminated from the police department, there's no report of it made, and in most cases you don't even see any media coverage on it. How much of that as a whole as far as policing across the country is done, I don't know. I think I agree with you. We can, like I say, speaking here locally, probably can do a better job of it. It's been a criticism for years about the police policing themselves, and you got civilian review boards. You got civilian review boards that even make recommendations to police departments when they look at a particular thing as far as an officer's employment. You have chiefs who will take action in regards to a situation. About a month ago, I was reading an article on the chief of police in Milwaukee, a shooting, which one of his officers involving an unarmed person. In that, he was not charged, but the chief took the immediate action based on the things that led up to the shooting to terminate the officer. But before he could do that, the officer had filed for a duty-related disability due to stress and PTSD. And by law, by 2 days, the disability claim will take precedence over the termination. So he could eventually be given a disability retirement and not terminate. That's just how it is. But so it takes individuals to hold individuals accountable. It takes other officers. You know, I've had some officers in my career come forward and report officers for misconduct, inappropriate behavior. And, you know, I've always commended those officers willing to step up. Because most of the officers that I know, or the majority of the ones I know out there, they don't condone inappropriate behavior by other officers. And they're not going to sit by and watch another officer continue or to be involved in inappropriate behavior.
Thank you.
Thank you. One last question.
Yeah. And you've been listening to Major Anthony L. from the Kansas City Police Department. His topic today on the All Souls Forum was how not to be Ferguson. Hope you found this an informative and provocative in some ways program. This program was recorded on Sunday, November 30th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. This show is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help each week in producing this program. The theme song you are listening to is written, played, recorded by Kansas City composer Fred Potter. Tune in again next week for another All Souls Forum right here on KKFI. And You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.